Please join me in a spirit of prayer. We do lift up our hearts in thanks for the gifts of life and love, for songs in our hearts and words of peace and justice. So many candles have been lit along the wall today, signifying so full lives coming into this place. Lives which exist in the midst of hope and anxiety, health and sickness, youth and age, all together. Many of us come into this place worried about the future that lies before us. And so many bring with them hope of better days ahead. Let us, in this community, find those lights we light within one another. Retain gifts of life and love and friendship in the knowledge that together we can build, step by step, a better world. I went to my culture this week in search for the meaning of love. And this is what I found. The film Love Story told me that love means never having to say you're sorry. St. Paul told me that love is patient and kind. He said, I may have all knowledge and understand all secrets. I may have all the faith needed to move mountains, but if I have not love, I am nothing. The other St. Paul, along with St. John, told me all you need is love. In one database, I found 3,419 songs with love in its title, and I only found 124 songs with work in the title. Take what meaning you want from that. I was told by others that love looked like diamonds or chocolate. Still, others told me that love looks like sex or marriage or friendship. Some said God is love. And, if I'm to believe what I found in my newspaper's comic strip section, love is apparently what happens between two very strange-looking naked people who live together. Have you seen that comic strip? I went to my culture in search for the meaning of love, and this is what I found. Mixed messages. It's not unusual for me to find that in my life, what brings about reflection in my religious life often comes from very strange places. And this time, the main catalyst came from the television comedy called Scrubs. Now, in one scene, the main character, JD, is daydreaming about visiting one of his friend's churches. Now, I don't remember a lot about the scene, except that in the end, as the preacher is ending the worship service, this very charismatic minister turns to the congregation and says, I love you, and there's nothing you can do about it. I love you, and there's nothing you can do about it. In our modern expression of Unitarian Universalism, I hear us talk about a lot of things as if they're inevitable. Truth is inevitable for us. I hear a lot of us talk about a growing understanding and experience of life and time as unavoidable, or a growing complexity and diversity in life as unavoidable. But you know what I don't often hear us call unavoidable? Love. I don't often hear us in Unitarian Universalist context talk about this kind of irresistible love that would say, I love you, and there's nothing you can do about it. However, running deep in our religious heritage and in the DNA of our history is the notion that a profound and mature love has the power to break so many other barriers. In 1568, the first and only Unitarian king in all history enacted what was called the Edict of Torda. It was the first law of religious toleration ever in a nation's history. Now, it provided for all variations of the Christian religion only, but at the time, it was a big step in the right direction. John Sigismund of Transylvania, the king at the time, was counseled by his Unitarian court minister, Francis David, who's famously noted, "We need not think alike to love alike." What do you think we love? Religious thinkers and practitioners and scientists and philosophers and everybody else has known for hundreds and hundreds of years that we are shaped so much by what we hold dear, that we're transformed by what it is we love. The term worship comes from an older word just meaning to assign value, to give worth-ship to something. It seems like this kind of devotion and love and attention is something that's kind of unavoidable in life. Our own Ralph Waldo Emerson said this, "A person will worship something. Have no doubt about that. We may think that our tribute is paid in dark recesses of our hearts, but it will out. That which dominates our imagination and our thoughts will determine our lives and our character. Therefore," he says, "it behooves us to be careful what we worship. For what we are worshiping, we are becoming." Around 50 years ago, the liberal Christian theologian Paul Tillich said something similar. He said that for him, this kind of love is powerful and dangerous all at the same time. For him, we can devote our ultimate attention to things that ultimately don't deserve it. Tillich said that everybody, including atheists, he said, make gods out of things that aren't gods. Make gods out of things that don't deserve that title or the attention. Our misplaced love has us making gods out of money and power, has us chasing after being liked or status. Misplaced love can have us paying tribute to the shabby deities of a flag or a tribe. Like Emerson, Tillich knew that we will worship something, but what we give our ultimate love to should be the most ultimate things possible. So what will we love? I know in my own life, it's really easy to have the wrong kind of love. I give my ultimate attention to things that don't ultimately deserve it all the time. I know that I love my wife and my family and friends. I know that I love my church. And I devote my attention and love to the creative emergent force in the universe that I call God. But I bet I'm not the only one in the room today who's found that it's very tempting to fall in love with other things too. Like my ego. It's easy to fall in love with being right all the time. I found that it's easy to fall in love with possessions or a particular cause or one way of doing things or being liked. On the other side, it's tempting for us to believe that we know who deserves love in the world and who doesn't. And it's up to us to make that decision because we've only got a brief time on the planet and we should really know before we get out of here. I tell you, I can get revved up on a Sunday morning, leaving the sanctuary, believing that all human beings are part of one giant family of creation and love, and then a few hours later, go home and turn on my television and think some very unlovely things about the people I see. People who vote differently than I do, people who think differently than I do, or spend their money and resources differently than I do. It's really simple for me to talk about that world in which we need not think alike to love alike. Really hard for me to live in it. Sometimes things get turned around and it seems like we're the ones who don't deserve love. I wonder if I'm the only person in the sanctuary today who's ever felt like they screwed up so bad that there was little chance they were going to be liked, let alone loved. Now, I know deep down that I'm never disconnected from the world. I'm never disconnected from what's good or sacred, and there's never the chance that I can't open myself up to wholeness again. I know these things, but it's really easy to believe that they're not true. This is certainly no new issue in religion. At least one huge branch of our religious heritage was forged out of this question of who deserves love. Who is it that deserves to be treated equally in the eyes of the world or the sacred or God? Now, although there were many believers of universalism before him, the Reverend John Murray is often called the father of American universalism because he was the first one to start an explicitly universalist church in the country. Murray and our other early universalist Christian ancestors talked about what they called the doctrine of universal salvation. For them, it meant that no loving deity could rightly accuse a finite being to eternal punishment. For us, we might say, we don't know what happens when you die, but we bet it happens to everybody. As you can tell, in a time of a lot of fire and brimstone preaching, Murray's position wasn't always the easiest one to take. So one day he was preaching in Boston and got a lot of applause after this sermon. He was really working the crowd. And at the time, there was an Orthodox minister in town named Reverend Bacon. He got very angry at what he heard, got his followers together. They left, started gathering eggs, came back in, and while Murray's in the pulpit, throw them at him and start pelting him with eggs at the end of the sermon. Now, for all of you who are fans of a corny joke or a pun, you'll be very happy to know that our Right Reverend Murray immediately responded, "These are moving arguments, but I must own that I have never been so fully treated to bacon and eggs in all my life." Bad, huh? Something about universalism gives you a sense of humor. In our historical heritage, there's this long-standing tradition of people who affirmed that, yes, we are shaped by what we love, but for them, we're just as shaped by what loves us. Kind of a weird idea for modern people. Kind of hard for me to wrap my mind around. It was this notion of an irresistible love that brought into being one of the most influential figures in the history of this movement and a person without whom we would not be here, who you've probably never heard of, or at least don't hear much of lately. In 1794, at the age of 22, Hosea Ballou was ordained at the Universalist General Convention without knowing it. There was a big sermon going on at the convention, and right at the climax, Ellihan Winchester, the minister, took a Bible and ran into the crowd and put it against Hosea Ballou's chest and ordained him that moment. This newly ordained young Universalist minister, while he didn't preach about this much, actually became a Unitarian in his theology. So he was technically one of the first Unitarian Universalists we ever had in our tradition. When he was 33 years old, he wrote a text that was foundational in shaping Christian thought and now our own UU thought. It was called A Treatise on Atonement. Now, I'm going to do this a great disservice. He would be very angry at me by boiling down this wonderful text into about three sentences. Basically, what Ballou said was this. If we're finite beings, and what we do wrong in life is finite, it makes absolutely no sense for an infinite God to bring the infinite power of the universe down to punish one finite being for doing what finite beings do. He then turned it around, something nobody had ever said before, at least in his world, and said that in this religious relationship, it's not God who's the dissatisfied party. It's human beings. For Ballou, it's not that God needs to be reconciled through anybody to humans, but the other way around. Now, in our language today, we might say it like this. It's not that life has a problem with us. Sometimes we have a problem with life. Like many before him, he asserted that when you're getting into creeds and doctrines like we do today, the best bet is to have a generously placed love. Here's what he said. "Be cautious in any system of divinity," he warns. "For the moment we start to fancy ourselves infallible, everybody else has to meet our peculiarities or we cast them away. If we agree in love, no disagreement will do us harm. But if we don't, no agreement will do us any good." I think Ballou said some things in 1805 that would be radical in a lot of churches today, including our own. What he was saying is, let's get over quibbling about the finite terms and the exact phrases in religion and philosophy. Let's get over the idea that salvation is about having somebody's anger disappear. Salvation is about falling in love with life. Real life. It makes sense that in the tradition out of which he came, when the teacher Jesus was asked to sum up the entirety of Jewish law, he said there were only two things that mattered. To love your God with all your heart and soul and mind and strength, and to love your neighbor like it was yourself. Do you think that much has really changed for us? A lot of us don't use the word God, but we might be able to say, if you're going to make a God out of something, if we're going to give our worship to something, it had better be worthy of our devotion. And when we do, let us serve it with all of our strength and serve our neighbor with the same. I think it's about a worthy idea. So my friends, what is it that you will choose to love? What would it look like for the people in this room to get reconciled to life? What would it look like if you got right with life again? There's a lot of trouble coming in our direction from life, and it's hard sometimes to believe that it's not against us. Like life might be on our side. We can assert, like so many before us, that we know there's not people who are damned because of their religious beliefs, but on the other hand, we're kind of saved a little bit every day. Like we read together in the responsive reading today, every single day we're warmed by a sun we didn't create. We eat food that we could plant but never grow, and we're held in a community that we could never earn and could never buy. Nobody's damned, but we're all saved a little bit every day. Now, whether you're joining us for the first time or one time of many, know that you belong here. And by here, we mean earth. You belong here. We assert that we live in a reality in which every single human being is worthy of love, and that includes you. That everybody participates in the sacred, and there's nothing you can do about it. It's a world which we might imagine poetically saying, I love you, and there's nothing you can do about it. Let's say for a moment this was true. How would you respond to that type of world? What type of life and what type of life spent loving would you spend after knowing that? This kind of love isn't easy. It's not the kind of love that gets summed up in a greeting card or a television commercial or a newspaper strip or a verse or a song. This is being reconciled with life. Anybody who has a parent or a sibling or a child or a friend or a partner or anybody that they love knows that love never expects perfection, right? Love has great waves and is very difficult sometimes. I think the same will be true of our response to life. So many people in the world and so many people in this room are having experiences that make it very hard for them to believe that life is on their side. For a lot of us, it seems the exact opposite. And so it's our job to join together to show our friends that this, while a difficult life, is one worth loving. Hundreds of years ago, this is the call that John Murray issued to the universalists he knew. Go out to the highways and byways of America, your new country, and give the people who are blanketed with a decaying and crumbling Calvinism something of your new vision. You may possess only a small light, but use it. Uncover it and give to the people a new vision for men and women. Give them not hell, but hope and courage. Now, this was obviously a successful call at the time. At one point in the 1800s, Universalist churches alone had 600,000 members. That's about four times what UU churches have today. It was the fifth largest denomination in the country. In fact, they did such a good job that they almost put themselves out of business. As more and more people started to affirm that hell didn't await anybody that was different than them, universalism lost a little bit of its bite. It wasn't so special anymore. It seems that in our time, we have some situations that are kind of similar to Murray's. So many people in our country and the world are blanketed in this understanding of religion that is crumbling. It's not working in a changing world. And they don't know there's an alternative. Let's not be the ones to hide it from them. Let us too go out and give something of our new vision to people. Not hell, but hope. The vision that every person, conservative and liberal and gay and straight and black and white and whatever label you could put on it, deserves love, and it doesn't matter what you believe if you act out of that. A world in which if we agree in love, no disagreement can do us harm. Come on, let's do this so good that we put ourselves out of a job. That in 20 years, this understanding is passé, commonplace. People would say, oh yeah, we get that already. Let's put ourselves out of a job. Let's find together those things which are really worthy of our devotion. And when we do, let's serve it with all of our hearts and mind and strength. Let's find a way to say to the world, I love you, and there's nothing you can do about it. What better time than now? Amen.